Reading today is taken from John chapter 5, verses 1 to 18. This can be found in the Church Bibles, page 1073. After this, there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Now there in Jerusalem, by the Sheep Gate, a pool in Aramaic called Bethesda, which has five roof colonnades. In these lay a multitude of invalids, blind, lame, and paralyzed. One man was there who had been an invalid for 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and knew that he had already been there a long time, he said to him, "Do you want to be healed?" The sick man answered him, "Sir, I have no one to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up, and while I am going, another steps down before me." Jesus said to him, "Get up, take up your bed, and walk." And at once the man was healed, and he took up his bed and walked. Now that day was the Sabbath, so the Jews said to the man who had been healed, "It is the Sabbath, and it is not lawful for you to take up your bed." But he answered them, "The man who healed me, that man said to me, 'Take up your bed and walk.'" They asked him, "Who is this man who said to you, 'Take up your bed and walk?'" Now the man who had been healed did not know who it was, for Jesus had withdrawn, as there was a crowd in the place. Afterwards, Jesus found him in the temple and said to him, "See, you are well. Sin no more, that nothing worse may happen to you." The man went away and told the Jews that it was Jesus who had healed him. And this was why the Jews were persecuting Jesus, because he was doing these things on the Sabbath. But Jesus answered them, "My Father is working until now, and I am working." This was why the Jews were seeking all the more to kill him, because not only was he breaking the Sabbath, but he was even calling God his own Father, making himself equal with God. Let me start. December the 26th, 2004, Phuket. John Croston was in the water at Kamala Bay, and he suddenly experienced this strange thing of the water all around him just disappeared, and these boats plotted all around were just left marooned, stranded, and these fish were left gasping for breath all around him. And afterwards he said this, "I've studied some geology, and in an instant I was overtaken with the overwhelming certainty that we were about to experience a tsunami." So what did he do? Well, he sprinted up the beach, and he started yelling to everyone in sight, "Tsunami, tsunami!" And there was this shuttle bus that had just arrived at the beach from a hotel, and he started pleading with the bus driver to turn the bus around and go, and he urged everyone on the beach just to flee as quick as they could. He later said this, "I consider myself relatively reserved, not praying to overreaction, but on that beach I let all my inhibitions go." Now when people heard John Croston on that beach, they knew that they were listening to a man who knew what he was talking about, and particularly someone who meant what he said. And because he explained exactly what people had to do personally to avoid the crisis, thankfully lots of people, not everyone, but many people, heeded his warning, and they're alive today to tell the tale. Now my aim in talking today is that you and I tune into and hear Jesus' warning to us. It's about a much more serious disaster that is coming than a tsunami. It's about a disaster which will affect every human being on this earth. And the man who warns us about it is a man whom, as we're going to see, truly knows what he's talking about. And he means what he says. And so my prayer for all of us in this room is that we will be those who heed his warning, who take it seriously, and then live to tell the tale. So let's get into our passage and see what it's all about. Now in the section that we had read, Jesus performed an amazing miracle. So he sought out And then he healed this guy who had been unable to walk for 38 years. And just by saying those words, "Get up," he instantly and completely healed the man. Now I really want us to look at what Jesus is teaching us through this miracle. And I've put on the sheet there, if you've got these white sheets, the two big things that I believe Jesus was trying to communicate. But before we look at those, I just want to acknowledge that there will be, I'm guessing, some in this room for whom even the possibility of miracles in general is a problem for you. Or perhaps you're unconvinced about the authenticity of Jesus' miracles. Now, today I'm not going to spend any time really on that issue. But I do recognise it is a big issue for lots of people. It's an important issue. And so please, if that is you, do bring it up in the question time. We have a question time after the end of the service, or catch me afterwards, because it is an important one to address. But with the remaining time that we have together, let's look at just what Jesus is teaching us through this miracle. And I'll put there on the tops of the sheets, the miracle points to the rescue that Jesus has come to bring. So it's interesting that for Jesus, doing this extraordinary act, an act which completely transformed this man's life, it wasn't a random act of kindness. It wasn't an end in itself. But actually Jesus has a much bigger agenda for this guy and for all of us than simply improving his lot in life. And this bigger agenda Jesus has is demonstrated by the way Jesus, after the event, goes and seeks out the man to explain what the miracle points to. So, verse 14, we read this. Afterward, Jesus found the healed man in the temple and said to him, "See, you are well. Sin no more, that nothing worse may happen to you." So as I put on the sheets, the miracle is not an end in itself, but it points beyond itself towards something far greater, which is that Jesus rescues us, as verse 14 puts it, from something far worse. Jesus' agenda for this man is not simply a healed body, but a healed life. Sure, Jesus says, "I may have radically transformed your remaining years in this life, but believe me when I say to you that the misery that you have so far experienced in your life, a misery which has been tragic and intense and prolonged for this guy, believe me when I say to you that unless you turn from your sin, unless you turn from your life of living independently from your Creator, living as if you are God in your life, unless you turn from that," Jesus says, "there is something worse which will happen to you." So we see Jesus' agenda is much greater than simply seeing this guy rescued from his paralysis. Jesus wants to see this man rescued from what the Bible calls hell. That is the something worse which Jesus refers to in this verse. So Jesus spoke very often and very graphically about this judgment which is coming, as he does, for example, in the passage immediately following this one. And it's a judgment which he taught that all human beings deserve, all except one, that is. And it's the judgment for taking our Creator's gifts and then spurning his love and rejecting him. It's the judgment which I deserve for deciding that I, rather than God, will be God in my life. Now, some of us do this in very dramatic, very immoral ways. Or probably for lots in this room, we may do it in very respectable, very religious ways. But the point is, however we do it, by being very bad or by being very good, we all insist on being in the driving seat of our lives, rather than acknowledging and submitting to our Creator, the one who gives us everything we have. So we all take the gifts and reject or ignore the giver. And Jesus teaches that the very reason he came is to provide a rescue from this judgment for all who will accept it. And so Jesus' agenda for this man and for each of us is that we turn from our sin
as verse 14 says, and accept this rescue. Now I know from the tone in this room right now, I know this may not be the warm and fluffy message you were looking forward to on a Sunday evening. But you see, Jesus Christ is the gentlest. He's the kindest man who has ever lived. And like John Croston, he is not prone to overreaction or indeed any kind of exaggeration. And the reason Jesus speaks so often and so graphically about this judgment is precisely because he loves us. And he longs that we will be those who take this warning seriously and then live to tell the tale. So please, do not make the mistake that some on that Phuket beach did and ignore this warning. Now, I think one of the things that that makes us inclined to ignore this kind of warning, not to take this sort of warning from Jesus as seriously as we should, either for ourselves or perhaps we don't take it very seriously for our loved ones and for those around us, is that we think that somehow we and they will be able to muddle through. Sure, there might be a judgment coming, but actually, I'm a lot better than most people. Really, I'll be fine. It's a bit like those people on the Phuket beach saying, sure, there might be a tsunami coming, but really, I'm a lot better at swimming than most people. Really, I'll be fine. And sadly, there were some on that Phuket beach who, for whatever reason, thought that they didn't need to take the warning seriously. But one of the things that this passage emphasizes is the hopelessness of this man's predicament before Jesus intervenes. So let's look at verse 7. It says this, "The sick man answered Jesus, 'Sir, I have no one to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up. And while I'm going, another steps down before me.'" So all this man's hopes in life are pinned on a local superstition, that if only he can be the first into the pool when the water is stirred up, then he will be healed. But do you see, there's this bitter irony that it's his very disability which disqualifies him from being healed, because others always get there before him. And so this man illustrates for us our terrible human predicament, the inability we have as human beings to heal and to save ourselves before Jesus intervenes. So that guy lying by the pool there is a visual aid, a picture of each one of us before Jesus intervenes. The man has no real hope in life. He exists, but it is not the life that he was created for. And this man's paralysis is a poignant visual aid of what has happened to the human race as a result of our walking out on God. And when we walk out on God, our days are shot through with death. We're a bit like cut flowers. I cut this from our garden before I left, so I'm hoping my landlady won't be very cross. So we're like cut flowers. We are beautiful for a time, but every petal that withers and falls to the floor is a reminder to us that these flowers have been cut off from our life source. So death is not something that will happen to us one day in the future. It is something that is already happening to us. And as with cut flowers, it is just a matter of time until we're removed from the vase altogether. And in the meantime, you and I can try anything we like. We can lose weight, we can eat superfoods, we can have our teeth whitened, we can dye our hair, we can run 3 times a week, we can do the triathlon. But none of it amounts to more than sticking these fallen petals back on to the flower. Do you see, we try and wriggle out of the grip that death has on us. But our only hope is to be reconnected to the God who is the source of our life. And when we are reconnected to him, then the wonderful reality is that death is no longer the end for us, because he promises to get us through death. I put there on the sheets, he rescues us from something worse, for something far better. One of the incredible features of Jesus' miracle here is that, and if you were here last week, this will be familiar. Jesus just speaks a word to this guy in verse 8. Get up, take up your bed and walk. And then verse 9, at once the man was healed and he took up his bed and walked. So here's a guy, he has not walked for 38 years. His muscles would have wasted away long ago. And yet he immediately leaps to his feet and he walks away without so much as a limp or a stumble. He doesn't have any need for a physio. Do you see, Jesus, by merely speaking, he recreates this man's legs as they were always supposed to be. And this is a picture for each of us of the rescue which Jesus has come to bring. He has come to rescue us for something far better, to restore us into the people that he always purposed us to be. So Jesus Christ intends to remake me into the Andrew Latimer that I was supposed to be, which is obviously going to involve quite a few significant changes. And he intends to remake you into the you that you were supposed to be. And actually, that work has started even now, if we're those who have turned to Jesus. Because as we turn to him, he begins to remake us, remake our hearts, our desires, our loves, our hates, to be as they were supposed to be, bit by bit. And then when Jesus returns, he will complete this work in our characters, but also in our bodies, so that every part of us, just like that man's legs, will be restored to the Creator's original design. There's a guy in the church that I grew up in, also called Andrew, who has had multiple sclerosis for all of his life. And he's been severely disabled. He found walking and talking a real struggle. But Andrew was a keen Cambridge United fan. He loved football. And Andrew would often talk about, talking for him was slow, it was faltering. He found talking a real challenge. But he often used to talk excitedly about the day that he was looking forward to when his Saviour, the Lord Jesus, is going to return and when Andrew would get to play football for the first time with wonderful, strong legs and perfect coordination. And this is the rescue which Jesus has come to bring, restoring each one of his people to the way that we were made to be. Just like he did with that man's legs. Now it's worth mentioning that some people, when they read of Jesus' wonderful power to restore people's bodies, they assume that this transformation is available to us right now in this life. And that if only we have enough faith, we should be expecting exactly the same kinds of dramatic healings as Jesus demonstrates in the passage today. And of course, if we or those we know are suffering, of course we long for, of course we pray for healing. But I don't think that that is what this passage is here to promise us. So one of the great things about the way the Bible is written is that it interprets itself. We don't just have a record of events and then we have to speculate about what these events could possibly mean. No, the meaning of the events is also given to us. And what this sign, this miracle, is pointing to is actually explained in the passage which follows this one, which we're going to look at next week, where Jesus explains how it points to his divine authority to give new life and to judge, and how the resurrection bodies that we long for await that final resurrection day when Jesus returns. So, of course, we pray for God to heal today. Of course we do. And mercifully, sometimes he does. And there'll be some in this room who can testify of ways God has been kind in bringing healing. But ultimately, our solid hope, our unwavering hope, as that guy from my old church, Andrew, demonstrated, our real hope is in the final resurrection, when Jesus will restore every part of us to the way we were made to be, perfect and imperishable. Now, a lot of people assume that returning to God will make us odd in some way. It will in some way restrict us, it will constrain us, it will narrow us, it will make us slightly less human, slightly less alive. But do you see that the reality could not be further from the truth? Just as the whale was made for the ocean, you and I were made for God. Relationship with God is the environment we were created to thrive within. And yet when we walked out on God, it was like a whale crashing out of the ocean. We thought it would set us free, but it has left us stranded there on the beach, lying there limp and wheezing. And it is not the life that we were created for. And so as we look at this world, and as we look honestly at ourselves, we see that walking out on God has left us, and it's left our societies, it's left our world, damaged and disfigured, just like that man's legs. But Jesus restores us to the way we were created to be. Gradually now, in our desires, in our relationships, and then suddenly and completely then, when our bodies and in fact the whole world will be wonderfully remade according to and in fact exceeding our Creator's design for us. Now, we might be thinking that all of this, it sounds amazing. In fact, there'll be some people, I guess, who think it sounds too amazing. It's too amazing to be true. It's a wonderful idea, but how do I know who's up to the job? If I entrust my life into Jesus' hands, how can I know that his hands are big enough? And actually, this is the second big thing that Jesus is teaching us through this miracle. So as the sheep say, the miracle points to Jesus' divine power to accomplish the rescue. Now, one of the strange things about this passage as we're reading through is that the healing is all over by verse 9. And the whole second half of the passage revolves around this issue of the particular day on which Jesus did the miracle, namely on the Sabbath, the Jewish day of the rest, the Saturday. Now, in the Ten Commandments back in the Old Testament, God had set aside one day of the week as a special day of rest for his people, and it was to be a great blessing for them. But over the years, the religious authorities had obscured God's original vision for that day behind a whole wall of rules and regulations about what did not constitute work. And so when this man, who had been paralyzed for 38 years, walks in carrying his bed on his shoulder, all they can say in verse 10 is, "It is the Sabbath, and it is not lawful for you to take up your bed." Carrying your bed is work, and you're not supposed to be doing any work. So do you see, this amazing thing has happened, and this is all that they're interested in. Now clearly, there was no urgency in the sick man's situation before the miracle. He's been paralyzed for 38 years. He'll still be lying there the next day if Jesus comes back then. And so Jesus is deliberately choosing the Sabbath day in order to try and make a point. And interestingly, when Jesus, later in this passage, is accused of breaking the Sabbath laws by commanding the guy to pick up his mat, instead of defending himself by explaining how the religious authorities had perverted and obscured God's original purpose for the Sabbath, instead, Jesus chooses to defend himself using a very, very different approach. So let's look at verse 17. "But Jesus answered them, 'My Father is working until now, and I am working.'" Now this is a jaw-dropping claim. Jesus' logic goes something like this, that the Jews agreed that even though it was forbidden for humans to work on the Sabbath, it was not forbidden for God to work on the Sabbath. Because after all, if God stopped working, then the universe would cease to be upheld, and the world which God continually sustains moment by moment would stop existing. And so Jesus is arguing, now you already know that it's not forbidden for God to work on the Sabbath. And equally, it is not forbidden for me. So Jesus, in this statement, is claiming equality with God. Equal responsibility in sustaining and upholding the universe, and therefore equal exemption from the Sabbath laws. Now, we may find this a complex argument to follow, but the shock of this claim is not lost on Jesus' original hearers, who immediately understand just what Jesus is claiming, and they consider it blasphemous, and they think he is deserving of death. Verse 18. This was why the Jews were seeking all the more to kill him, because not only was he breaking the Sabbath, but he was even calling God his own Father, making himself equal with God. Now, Jesus has been very deliberate about the timing of this miracle, and he's performed the miracle as he has done, not simply to point to this rescue which he's come to bring, but secondly, to point to his divine identity and therefore his power to execute this rescue. Jesus Christ is claiming here to be equal to God, equal to God the Father. Not a rival God, but one God in different persons. And all of this raises the stakes on everything that I've said so far. And it forces us to think very hard about Jesus Christ. Now, there was an exhibition in the O2 Centre, or the Millennium Dome as it was then called, when it was first opened. And the exhibition was about Jesus Christ being a great moral teacher who died tragically young. And that is the view, isn't it, of lots of people today about Jesus, a good man whose example we should follow. But please see that this option is not left open to us. Do you see, either Jesus is a godless blasphemer, either he's a self-absorbed, self-seeking egomaniac who's trying to claim the worship which belongs to God alone, or he is our creator and our judge, and the one person who really can achieve this wonderful rescue which we've been hearing about. Now, I don't know if you were here in London back in March 2001. That was the month of the unveiling of the Millennium Bridge. And from the moment it was revealed, you might remember, it was immediately dubbed the Wobbly Bridge, and it was immediately in need of fixing. Now, in 2001, I had my mobile phone switched on practically the whole year, and yet not one person thought of ringing me up and asking me if I'd come and fix the bridge. Now, unsurprisingly, they actually ended up calling the guy who created the bridge to come and fix it. So he's the engineer. He's called Roger Ridsdale Smith. He went straight over. He put up a few X-shaped braces, a few dampeners, and he sorted it out. But the point is, only the creator can really fix his creation. Now, in the case of that bridge, I'm guessing that there might be a few other people in the world with that level of expertise. But when it comes to fixing the creation, fixing everything which has gone wrong with this world, fixing everything that's gone wrong in your life and in mine, there is only one who has the power to put everything right. And he is the one who spoke creation into being in the first place. And do you see, that is why it is such good news to us that he has come. He's come to earth. That Jesus Christ really is the Creator God. Because do you see that he and he alone really does have the divine power necessary to bring this salvation about, to rescue us from something worse, the coming judgment, and to rescue us for something far better, reconnecting us to the one source of life, restoring us to the way we were created to be. And so, whoever we are this evening, Jesus Christ is standing there on the beach in front of us. The one man who, above all other human beings, really does know what he's talking about. And he really means what he says. And he is pleading with each one of us to take this warning seriously and to receive this rescue, which he alone can bring. And if we are those today, and lots of us will be, who have responded, if we're those who are already experiencing this new life with God and the beginnings of this restoration to become the way we were made to be, then the message of this passage for us is be encouraged. Be encouraged. Because whatever you're facing at the moment, and I'm guessing there'll be certain situations here which are dreadful situations which cannot be easily fixed, the one into whose hands you have committed your future and your life is the only one with hands strong enough and powerful enough to put everything right. And so you have put your life in exactly the right place. And so you can go away from here as you walk onto the quay this evening, secure. You can walk away safe and rejoicing and hopeful in all that's to come. I'm going to leave a time in a moment for us to respond personally to God in the quiet. But before we do that, let me lead us all in a prayer.